About unshakable peace, and so I want to kind of guide us in a little bit with our meditation. We'll do about 30 minutes here, and then I'll talk a little bit about it and take your questions and see how this idea, do you even think unshakable peace is possible for you in your life, the way things are? And maybe you can think about it now on the front end. Like, just the idea of that. That's like, yeah, no, that can't happen. And then maybe by the time we get to the questions and responses or answers, you might have a different feel based on what you hear from the Dhamma, that maybe something you thought would be unattainable is actually attainable. And so, yeah, so let's start with a sit. We will, hey, Raj, all the way from Canada.
Oh my God, you did recognize me. Good morning. So good to see you.
That's good to see you too. I haven't seen Raj.
I came because of the subject. I wanted to learn more from you.
Great. I haven't seen Raj in ages. I'm sorry. I just could not help that. Great.
Okay. You're welcome to come to visit me anytime. We can talk offline.
Yeah. Okay. So let's find a comfortable seat here. And before trying to meditate, what if you just took a moment to just notice? Let's start with silence. Can you just notice eyes closed or gaze lowered? Can you just notice the silence? You know, there may be sounds that are happening where you're at, but there is a silence that you might could tap into underneath those sounds. And I have been thinking since connecting on Zoom so much that is the same silence everyone on this call is experiencing. That it's not just contained in your space. It's not even contained in your house or apartment or your neighborhood, that silence is actually tied to all the silence from all over the world. Wherever you're at, we are all tied to that same silence. We are all interconnected to it. And just like in a room, when you're in a meditation hall, you could feel into the silence into that room, and every other practitioner in that room can feel into the silence in their own way. That's what's happening here. We're all feeling into this silence, and you could just every once in a while, as we're going through the sit, shift your energy and feel into that silence and be interconnected with everyone. And each one of us, in the midst of this silence, has sounds that are arising. Some of us are in places where there's lots of little sounds going on. Some of us, it might be barely a sound, but there is sound that can be heard by the ears that are arising within that silence. It's our subjective experience of this more universal happening. So you could rest in the silence that we're all carrying, we're all experiencing, and you could just notice the sounds that are arising here now for you. Sometimes it can be breathtaking when I just think about how interconnected we actually are, how close and intimate we are. that we're so fortunate to live in a world, in an age, where we could actually know this as a reality. And then maybe you could shift, or maybe your attention can remain steadier if you just feel into your own particular body's posture and the sensations that are arising here and now. This more inward turning towards your own experience. Here, now, this moment, the weight of the body, maybe the loosening, any kind of tightness that's in the body. Your whole meditation could just be loosening tightness. Just loosening, releasing, letting go of any kind of holding and tension. You don't have to make yourself reach a certain mental state. You can just arrive with whatever body you have, in whatever place it's at, and then just starting at the tip of the head, working your way down, see if you can release or loosen any tightness. Just go slow, no rush. Not trying to get to any state, just experiencing this present moment, noticing if there's tightness, and can it be loosened? Can it be released? And that felt sense, tightness or release, the movement in the body, tinglings, the pressure, just the constant shifting and changing of sensations in the body. You could just notice that for the whole period, all of it happening right now. And then finally, some of you might rest just with one sensation of the body breathing. This feeling, the belly rising or expanding and contracting, the chest rising and falling, or maybe feeling the whole body kind of brighten and then relax and brighten and relax. So whether it's sound or sensations or breath, because of the changing nature of these three things, constantly changing without any effort from us, the breath changes, sensations change, sounds rise and fall. All happening in the present moment. You could begin to learn something, begin to see something. So if you could generate interest in that, changing, shifting nature could keep your attention for a long time. But for many of us, there will be thinking, and the mind will wander off. It will judge all sensations as the same, all sounds as the same. The breath, I've seen one breath, you've seen it all. So it can get very bored very quickly with what it perceives as just the same old thing. And it'll get lost in thought. It's okay. It's just what minds do, just like ears hear and body senses and eyes see. Mind thinks. But the sound, the sensation, and the breath are anchors. Because no matter how much the mind thinks, breathing never stops. Sensations don't stop changing. Sounds don't stop arising. And you might sense into that anchor in the background. Thinking is in the foreground. It's steady, still, ever present. And you could shift your attention and reconnect with that anchor and bring yourself right back into the present moment. So we'll sit here in silence for the rest of the time. The mind might wander off into thought again and again and again. Be gentle, be kind. Just gradually shift your attention back to your anchor. Really, it's back to the present moment, just sitting here or lying here, watching the changing nature of present moment. So in these last few minutes of the sit, take a moment to reflect on how this meditation was. What did you notice? Whatever happened just is part of practice. But oftentimes we leave a meditation without ever reflecting upon or contemplating what we noticed. What was it like? Maybe there were thoughts running through your head, and what were those stories? Where are they now? Is it important now that the bell is about to come? How did it feel when you were connected to the present moment? Did you notice that? How did it feel when you were thinking? Did you notice that? All of it is important information for your practice. Nothing is useless or a waste of time. I forgot to check my bell, so I hope that bell sounded okay. I forgot to check to see if it was okay. Good, good. Yeah, do check your meditations at the end. Give yourself a couple of minutes to check and see what you learned about it. All of it, even our lost in thought, even though we write it off, beginning to actually realize what lost in thought is, and seeing it, what you're doing with it, becomes very important in the cultivation of your own wisdom. As time goes on, you can see a lot. You can see a lot. So I want to talk about unshakable peace. And I want to start with this this moment that happened to me in December. So in December, the month of December, I always take the month and practice and do a personal practice at this retreat center not too far from me, too far from Seattle, called Cloud Mountain. And I go up there. That's where I used to practice all the time when I was coming into the Dhamma, and it's like my retreat home. And so I would go up there and practice all the time. And so now that I've started teaching, December is their work month. So they don't have retreats, and they basically are doing a lot of hammering and sawing and all kinds of that. But that sound of working always helps me stay present. And so I go up there in December and do this personal retreat. And each year I pick a theme and get a whole bunch of Dhamma talks and morning instructions off of Dhamma Seed. And then I begin to do the retreat just same way as if I were sitting in front of a whole bunch of teachers and they were guiding me. So I go through the same process. Same sit, walk, sit, walk, sit, walk from, 6 a.m. to 9. And one night, this year, I decided to do all the old masters, Thai forest masters, Ajahn Buddhadasa, Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Tomato, and I don't know if you know Pasika Keys, who was this fierce Thai laywoman. I mean, she does not play. So her and just a couple other people, Thai teachers, and I would listen to their talks and contemplate and try to practice with what I was learning. And I heard this Dhamma talk one night from Buddhadasa. Ajahn Buddhadasa gave a talk on this word called viveka. In Pali, it's viveka. And in English, that VI is translated as the utmost or supreme. And veka is translated from in English to mean a singleness. So it's like the utmost singleness. So the utmost one, and the universal way it's translated in English is seclusion. And so he was talking about seclusion and what seclusion was, and all about seclusion. So, if I take a step back, you like me, if you're like me, you think of meditation as being about relaxation. It's always pointed to relax. If you meditate, you will relax. You will be, easy, peaceful, everything's good, chilled, all like warm honey, nice and sweet and very, very soft and mushy. But anybody that practices any amount of time, there is a sense of that relaxation, but it's a tense kind of practice. It is like not an easy, soft practice. You got to give a little bit in here to do this meditation. And the way it's presented from the outside world, like, oh, come meditate, because there's so much relaxation. And then I feel for people that come into the practice and all they notice is a mind that's angry and tense all the time, that it can give the wrong impression to what meditation's doing. And so as I was listening to Buddhadasa talk about seclusion, which is what I'm going to talk about, I begin to understand a little bit more over that whole month, a different way to think about meditation. I don't think we are cultivating relaxation. I think we are cultivating resilience. I think we're cultivating a capacity to be with whatever. And the more that drama shows up in your mind and you stay there, the more resolved you become, the more resilience you have, and the weaker some of our habit patterns can be. So this moment happened. I'm laying in the bed, just kind of thinking over the day, and I had this thought: when did Buddhadasa give that talk? I looked, and he gave that talk in May of 1986, I think it was. And I was thinking, in May of 1986, my life was completely different. I was completely lost. I was a single parent. I had went back to school and got a degree. There were no jobs. The world was a mess. The Middle East was a mess. Anwar Sadat had gotten assassinated, and I was just miserable. I thought the coming of World War III was coming any minute now. And I was even regretting that I had brought children into the world because I wasn't even sure I was going to be able to take care of them. And I just remember the sense of just bewilderment of what I was going to do, not being sure. I had a degree, and yet I couldn't find a job. And I was laying there this past December thinking, oh my God, the world is exactly the same as it was in 1986. For those of you that are younger, you may not get this. You may think all of this is all new, like, oh my God, something's happening. It has been this way forever. My grandmother, who's now dead, she probably could tell you when she was living. Oh yeah, that's the way it was then too. But there's somehow I had this real understanding that while the world was the same, I was not. Who I am now is vastly different than who I was then. I have the same kind of unknown insecurity, same kind of difficulties that I had then. Finances are troubling. I don't have babies. They're kind of on their own now, but I still worry about them the same way I did when they were little bitty babies. They just don't listen to me as much as they did when they were little bitty. I can try to say something, but they don't really listen. But I realized that while Buddha Dasa was talking about seclusion, and I'm going to tell you what he was saying about it, what I translated that seclusion to be is resilience. That's what I have, even though I do feel tucked in. So what Buddha Dasa was describing as this seclusion is you can have physical viveka, you can have mental viveka, and he called it spiritual viveka. So physical viveka is sort of like when we go on retreat, or you might have a designated spot for your practice that you go to, or you have a sense of being physically held. The body can feel good one day, or whatever my aches and pains from the arthritis I have, it's not overwhelming. And physically, I feel tucked in and safe. And that sense of being secluded in the body with a sense of safety is this physical viveka. And sometimes when we go on retreats, even with people we don't even know, by the end of that retreat, you have a physical sense of feeling safe within the community. It could feel that way just sitting here, especially if you come to a sangha regularly, you begin to see faces. You don't even know their names. You don't know anything about them, but just seeing these faces each week, you begin to have a sense physically of being part of your family, your community, a sense of safety. It's a lot why gradually over the time, a lot of affinity groups, BIPOC groups and Black, Indigenous, people of color groups, and the LGBTQ community groups, especially in the States, have grown because while for white people, being in a room that's predominantly white feel safe. It would feel safe to me if I was in a room that had 100 Black people in there, one white person. But I guarantee you that white person's gonna be like, okay, I guess we're okay here. But for me, I'd be like happy. So all of a sudden they begin to realize you got to create these separate little sets so that the BIPOC people and the LGBTQAI community can begin to settle down in the body and have a physical sense of safety. You got to physically feel that and relax into it. If it's the same for women and men, if women went to a sit that's mostly men, it would be difficult. If men go to a sit where it's mostly women, they would feel like, well, I like it here, but I wish I had some more of my own little crew here so I could feel a little bit more settled and you can settle into the body. So when you get that physical sense of safety and you begin to feel into your body, you can rest and you can begin to hear the Dhamma. And you can begin to hear it at a level that it can be transformative. And so that he moved on to this mental seclusion and this mental viveka, citta viveka. The first one's kaya viveka and citta viveka. It's what happens to us when we go on retreat. Over the course of the days of this practice, diligent back and forth, it doesn't just have to be on long retreats, it can be on a day long. It's any really kind of sustained practice. And even if you were to practice once a day in your certain spot, over the time, your mind would begin to gradually know what to do when it goes to its spot. It begins to know how to settle down, how to sort of let the ripples in the pond move away, and the mind itself can become still. It can become as safe as the body can feel. When you feel connected to a sangha or a community, the mind actually begins to feel safe. And when the mind feels safe, we begin to settle. It's not that things don't happen that are unpleasant or whatever, but the mind begins to settle. And this is that citta viveka. And then he talked about one last one, which is he called Upada Viveka, which I had never heard of. I had only heard of Kaya Viveka and Chitta Viveka, body and mind. But he called it Upadi Viveka. And he called that spiritual Viveka, spiritual seclusion. And that spiritual seclusion is when your practice becomes your refuge. It is the refuge of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha that you know as long as you are connected to the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, you are going to feel like you have the capacity to be with whatever. Because the world is as it is, and it comes at us with all this craziness. It's almost like for those of us that are older, you don't really get that you're getting older until you get slammed with some kind of health thing. And then you're like, have this reality like, oh my God, that's right, I'm older. I can remember when all of a sudden the kind of energy I had when I was in my 20s was no more. And it just became a different world. And once that shift begins to happen, you begin to see something is changing and you have no control over it. So this viveka, this kind of spiritual viveka, is this same capacity of feeling safe in the body, safe in the mind. You feel safe in the world. And that's what I realized laying in the bed. I realized I feel safe in the world. The world is still spiritual, spinning around in its way. But I feel safe, not because I don't think there's any danger coming my way, but because I have a sense of resilience. I have a sense of inner sense that whatever comes up, I don't think there's anything that's going to come up that my practice cannot help me deal with it. Not that my practice can make it go away or make it better, but even the things that I cannot make go away or make better, my practice can help me bear it, know it, be with it, exist in this same peace and security that comes through practice. So there's a sutta where the Buddha, what's his name? Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, hears the Buddha tell a group of monks that he remained dwelling in emptiness. Emptiness, that's my word for seclusion. That's my word for resilience. And Ananda was a little like, did I hear him right? Wait a minute, how can you dwell in emptiness when you're doing all these things all the time? Because, you know, you might think, oh, the Buddha's off somewhere meditating in his seclusion, but no, he would come out of seclusion, like out of his meditation, and he would interact with all these people. And anyone that knows any kind of monastic, they are always involved in all these things. They don't live like we think one big long retreat. It's not really like that. It's a lot of work. And so Ananda goes to the Buddha and said, did I hear you correct? Did you say that you remained dwelling in emptiness? And the Buddha said, yes, you heard me correct. Just as before and now, I dwell in emptiness. And I take it when he said just as before or like before, I take it that he meant when he awakened, he was in this seclusion, this emptiness, this stillness, this unshakable peace. And that even though he interacts with all these different people, he still is connected to that. And what I was thinking was that that is this upadhi, viveka. This is what happens when you get really difficult news or something happens that's very disruptive to your life and you keep practicing in the midst of that. It's not like practice only when things are good or practice just to get through the bad stuff. There is this ever practicing component to Dhamma that you are practicing regardless of what's going on. And in the ebb and flow of life, you begin to cultivate an access to stillness and peace and resilience that becomes steady. That's what becomes steady. Your practice or the wisdom you gain from your practice and not the outside world. It remains chaotic, crazy. As long as there's greed, hatred, and delusion in the world, we are in trouble. So sometimes you might think, yeah, but the Buddha, I mean, he is the Buddha, so he must have came in with something that could help him awaken, but he's not me, you know. He didn't have my life, and he definitely doesn't have an ADD mind like I do. And you can have that sense that this isn't really about you. So I want to end with this really inspiring story, I think, from the Dhammapada. I just think it's inspiring myself because sometimes I think I love suttas and I love reading them because I love the inspiration of them. That's what I do. So at the this it's I think his name is Kalapantika, and Kalapantika was the brother. There was a wealthy person who had two kids, two boys, and his brother goes in to become a monk. And Kalapantika wanted to do that also. So he followed his brother when he got of age into this monastic order with the Buddha. But Kalapantika couldn't get it. He didn't have the kind of mind that could remember things. He didn't have the kind of mind that he couldn't even remember the instructions. And so I don't know if you guys realize this, but the way that the Dhamma has come to us is because monks were required, and nuns, I think, were required to remember certain Dhamma talks. So Ananda would assign Dhamma talks, and Sariputta would assign Dhamma talks to groups of monks to remember them. And they would have to recite it and memorize it and learn it. And then every once in a while, they would say, okay, you give the talk that the Buddha gave on such and such a day, whatever that talk was. So then eventually all that was written down. But for a long time, it wasn't. And the way we remembered it is because people would remember. And Kalapantika, he had a problem. He couldn't remember anything. He couldn't say the instructions. You would give him the instructions and he couldn't read it, repeat them back to you. So his brother got a little disappointed in him and basically said, you can't be a good monk. You can't do this. You gotta leave because you don't have it. You don't have what is the monkness, whatever makes you a monk. You don't have that. You gotta go. And so he left. He felt like, this is true. He left. And on his way, he came to the Buddha, saw the Buddha, and the Buddha gives him a different instruction. Buddha gives him one word, tells him to say that one word, sit in meditation, and just say the one word. I don't remember the word, but it was just a simple little word. And he gave him this piece of cloth that was a white piece of cloth and said, say the word and rub this cloth. And that's it. That's your practice. So he did. He said the word, rubs the cloth, and the more he rubbed it, the dirtier the cloth got. And the dirtier the cloth got, the more he began to realize that things were impermanent. And he goes through this whole insightful understanding and becomes an arhat. So the reason why this story inspires me is because Buddha didn't seem to care that he couldn't remember anything. His brother cared a lot about that, but Buddha didn't care. It's sort of like you take your practice the way you are, not, oh, I gotta be like the way I think practice is supposed to be. You take your practice the way you are, how whatever that looks like. And the Buddha gave him this basic instruction. You don't have to remember nothing. Just one word and rub this cloth. That's it. Might seem to the passerby that it doesn't work. And so at the end of the story, what the Buddha said was that you need three things. You need to be alive in a time when the wisdom of the Buddha is available, which we live in. You have to be in a place in conditions that you can hear that wisdom. And everyone here on this call, if you can join this call, you can do that. Because anybody that can't do that, they can't really, you know, there might be people in conditions that they can't just sit on a Zoom call and listen. But so everyone here has the capacity to both hear the Dhamma, and you have the conditions to be able to take it in and practice with it. And then thirdly, you need right instructions. And the Buddha gives right instructions. So that this Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, this path on conditionality, that is right instructions. That's what we have. And then he says that through diligence, mindfulness, and discipline, and control of one's senses, a person with wisdom can make themselves as an island which no flood can overwhelm. And that is what Kalapantaka did. He steadied his mind just with his one word and his cloth. And all of his doubt and craziness about who he was and what his brother said, and you gotta go and you don't belong, he steadied his mind, created this physical, mental, and spiritual seclusion that gave him this resolve to stay with this. And mostly because of his faith in the Buddha, because this was the Buddha's direct instruction to him. And that was it. So that's really what I wanted to leave you with. I wanted to encourage you to connect to your practice in a way that inspires your heart. Whatever that looks like, you got to see for yourself. For some of you, it may be hearing the music while you sit, or looking at something. It might be reading suttas, like it was for me for a long time. I just couldn't meditate. I had too much restlessness as anxiety. But I would read all these suttas for a long time. And eventually those suttas helped me begin to have faith, and I begin to settle the mind down. So it may not look like other people's way, but we're all practicing with the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness. And within that, our discipline, our dedication, we're gonna cultivate this and embody a strong sense of embodiment. And that embodiment will bring us this sense of resilience. It's unshakable, your resilience can be. And I don't know about you, but the more resilient I feel in the midst of dangerous situations, the more peaceful, very steady in the midst of all this chaos. Especially in this country, a lot of chaos. But I feel held in the Dhamma. So let's just take a moment and let these words go and see what arises, what words might arise for you. Good. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Let's just see if anybody wants to share anything. You don't have to have a question. You can just share whatever your thoughts are. Or if you have a question, we can talk a little bit about that too. Oh, good, okay. Xavier, we'll start with you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good, thank you. And first of all, good day. I hope you're doing fine. I have one question. I couldn't attend the meeting on time because I thought it was 3 o'clock here where I live, but actually when I came in, they already started. So I would like to hear from you which lesson would you give me to cultivate peace and resilience in the midst of all chaos, as you say right now. That would be fine for me. Thank you.
Okay, so it was I was sharing that I had heard a Dhamma talk from Buddhadasa, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who's a Thai monk. And what he was talking about is this word viveka, Viveka. It's translated as seclusion. So cultivating seclusion would be, if I were going to sum it up, cultivating seclusion, mindfulness, learning to practice diligently is what will bring this unshakable peace. Or in my sense, I translate that unshakable peace to mean resilience, so that you could be with whatever happens. All right, great. Let's see who's next here. Deborah? Deborah? Is that how you say it? Let's see. Well, while I'm waiting for Deborah, okay, let me do this one question in the chat. I have a busy mind and start many things and don't get anywhere. I'm new to Buddhist. Should I focus on reading sutras, the middle discourse after the Dhammapada? So what I would do is begin to get, I'd find a sangha so that you can have a group of people that you can practice with. Because sometimes if you practice by yourself when you have a busy mind or you are getting just new to the Dhamma, you think whatever's happening to you is about you. But really, when you're in a sangha, you begin to realize, oh yeah, this is what happens to everybody. It's not really about me at all. So you need a find a group that you could hear the Dhamma, listen to the Dhamma, and begin to see other practitioners. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, think about an object. Because no matter how busy your mind is, or no matter how busy you start things and don't finish things, I bet you could sit through an entire movie and watch it. I bet you can sit through an entire meal and eat. There's so many things that we can focus on and stay with that when you start trying to focus on something neutral, that's when the mind thinks this is boring, this is stupid, I gotta do something else, this isn't gonna work. So instead of trying to focus on like the breath, which is what I tried to meditate and all I had was anxiety. Instead, I would focus on standing at the sink and washing dishes. So if you have a dishwasher, don't use that dishwasher anymore. You wash those dishes and you stand there and you stay with the process of washing the dishes. You can pick anything, vacuuming the floor. It's not the object, it's not the breath, it's the willingness to stay with the process of doing something. And once you get your mind used to the idea that you're going to keep coming back to washing dishes, keep coming back to just the fact that you're going to vacuum the whole floor, sweep the whole floor. Gradually, your mind will get used to staying with something. Because I have ADD, so my mind is jumps all over the place. And my problem was, I thought there was something bad about the jumping all over the place, and that I was not a good meditator. I think that's where all the anxiety came from. But when I begin to realize, it's not for those of us with ADD, which is our attention cannot steady, that it's not keep your attention on this object, but do you know that you're vacuuming? Do you know that you're washing the dishes? And standing at the sink washing dishes is a much broader kind of object than trying to focus your attention on the breath. It's a broader object, and so you can steady your attention on this broader object of I'm doing this, I'm brushing my teeth, I'm washing clothes. So we don't put the clothes in the laundry and think about something else. When you're gonna put the clothes in the laundry, you pay attention to, I am putting the clothes in the laundry. And that process trains the mind on how to stay with something. And over time, that something can be as subtle as breathing, because you have trained the mind to know it's doing something. And that's what the mindfulness is getting at. So it's not necessarily the object as much as it is the knowing of what's happening. Do you see? Good. Jane, how about you?
Thank you so much. Really,
You're
it's a
welcome.
joy to be with you. And I want to thank you for what you just shared, because I'm a psychotherapist and I work with a lot of people with ADHD and ADD and meditation. Like, oh no, I can't meditate. But I love that you did what you did just now, because it is so much about just being present every moment of your day,
That's
whatever
right.
you're doing. And whether it's patting your dog, it's really feeling this the skin of the dog, or the hair of the dog, or the breathing that the dog is having. And it's all through my life, it's every moment, and so I want to thank you, because I just want to share that I've been faced with a lot of physical issues. I had three surgeries this past year, and I'm looking at another one coming up if someone will donate their kidney. And so I'm waiting for a kidney transplant. And I got to tell you, I don't know what I'd do if I hadn't been meditating all my life, because
That's right.
you named it beautifully. It's about resilience. It's about widening the window of tolerance, getting a capacity to embrace whatever I'm faced with,
That's right.
and not fighting it, accepting it, and just moving forward and
That's
staying in the
right.
present. And
That's
so
right,
I
because
thank you.
you didn't make the situation. And if you had a choice in it, you would have raised your hand and say, "Oh, can you give that to somebody else? Because I don't know if I'm ready for that right now."
I
So
just had open heart surgery. Give me a break.
That's right. We don't have a choice in these things. And to see your face with the smile and the laughter is beautiful. It's beautiful. That is a sign of practice. That's what
Well, and I
it is.
think it's also that every moment that I'm alive is such a gift for all of us, but especially me. I wake up every morning and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm here again. Thank you. Just one more day. And then every moment of my day is cherished, because I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So I can't, there is chaos in this world. And what gave me hope yesterday were all the marches. I
Yeah,
sat here,
me
listened to
too.
all the speeches and Joan Baez, my history, and just singing along and just feeling so much a part of something that I couldn't attend to, but I
Yeah,
could watch. And
that's
thank God
right.
for Zoom. And I'm so
That's right.
grateful. So I'm grateful for you, and I thank you for today, because you
You're
inspired
welcome.
me. Yeah,
Good,
thank you.
good, good. See, good.
Lots of love.
Well, I cannot say Bartleme, you're gonna have to help me with that, because that's a way outside of my language tolerance.
Hi, it's Bartłomiej. That's right. Hi, nice to meet you. Yeah,
Nice to meet you too.
hi. I just want to share something because you said before to look back at the meditation and what's happened, what, because we need to, this is wise reflections, how, why are we doing, why, and what is happening really. So I had this very spontaneous experience to witness something that probably you might be familiar with because you said you've been on a retreat long, your long retreats before. So it's something when you're sitting and your mind is really sleepy and sluggish and you're nearly falling asleep, but then there's this presence, intelligence, and suddenly you're awake. The flow of energy is flowing and you're like, what's happened, And where this came from, it's just there been something witnessing this whole process, and I can't even say it was me because it was different. It was something bigger than this, just this body, and there was this is connected to the topic because it was just this being with, How do we cultivate, this resilience? How we need to bear with, we need to witness it, we need to be present for it, for the experience, to not fall asleep. And I was trying as much as I could, during the meditation to not fall asleep. And I stayed awake, and it's just the mind just turned upside down. It just completely, changed, and there was a presence. And then there I was again, they're fully awake, and that's just one defilement, but we can take this to different defilement and we can witness the moments when it's actually changing if we're really present for it. And if we're slowing down on those kind of practices on the retreat, I think we can experience that also, So you might be familiar with it, but it's very interesting experience. And it's, I think I can take this further, to my daily experience. If there's anger arising, if there's impatience, or what do I do with? Do I, act it out, or just seeing this in me arising, and just allowing this to be, and just wait for that also to shift, and just maybe distract myself, or just being patient with it. So yeah, I just want to share this. I found this very interesting experience, this. Just what's happened during the meditation, so I'm grateful for that. So thank
Yes, I'm
you.
grateful. I'm glad you shared that because this is why I tell people to actually kind of reflect upon their meditation right at the end before they stop and just go off. Because that moment probably didn't seem very big. It just seemed like a moment, like something happened and then there was energy and you're good. And then it could have come at the very end when the bell rings, you know? There's all kinds of ways it shows up. But what you're speaking to is a specific part of practice. You're speaking to what the Buddha pointed to, those five hindrances that show up in meditation. That what we call sleepiness, but it's kind of a sloth and torpor. It is a hair, like a hair shift from samadhi. So samadhi is the extreme sense of calm and this kind of body mental seclusion. But if you don't have any interest, that samadhi can turn into sleepiness. You're so calm, but you're not interested, so the mind will go to sleep. And so learning to see that, like you're describing, is this wisdom growing, this growing, the diligence that you showed, like, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep. It's not that it's bad or good or right or wrong. You could have went to sleep. But in this case, you saw something and you noted it. Oh, that diligence to stay awake brings with it energy. And that's the mindfulness, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep is like the mindfulness bell that's constantly ringing there. And it brings a level of stability. At the same time, if you have a lot of don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, but you don't have any calm, it turns into restlessness because it's just active mind, but you don't have any calm. So that is a hare, that's the restlessness, is this hare move between being too excessively thinking without enough calm to balance that, settle it a little bit. And so it's the same, the hindrances, that's our energy level. And then there's wanting and not wanting. We can get so caught in wanting something, wanting something, wanting something, that we don't actually see is not here, or not wanting something, not wanting something. That same thing, you steady your attention to just accepting what is present, just as it is. Keep your energy both calm and balanced. And because we're like on this teeter-totter, teetering between wanting and not wanting, and a lot of mental activity and calm, there's all this doubt that swirls around it just naturally. It doesn't have anything to do. It's the nature of the practice. But as you begin to teeter, like this moment you had when you noticed this, like, oh, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep, don't go to sleep. And then somehow you had access to this energy that brings wisdom. Like, oh, there's something about all this. And then that
Very
energy,
rewarding, yeah.
that's right, that keeps you connected, keeps you wanting to practice. And yeah, so that's what's happening. Very nice.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Nice
Yeah,
to meet you.
thank you. Thank you. All right, let's see. Let me check the chat and see if there's any questions. I don't think I noticed any questions, but let's see. It's always good to remember the unpleasant moments are part of the journey as well. Yes, that's right. Oh, definitely. In fact, what I think, if, for Xavier, what you're saying here, I think that the Buddha, it's very strange. He didn't find peace. He had access to peace, right? That's not what made him awaken. It wasn't like, oh, now he was really, really, really relaxed and peaceful. He always had access to that peace. When he first went home, he found these teachers and he could do deep meditative jhana practice, what we know of as jhana practice. He could do that, but that was not it. He realized, just because I can do deep meditation and jhana, that's not it. There's something else that's happening here. And what he stumbled upon was this realization that if he doesn't do anything and he steadies himself, whatever mental activity that arises, that mental activity will pass away on his own, on its own. If I don't engage with the storyline, it'll rise and pass, rise and pass, rise and pass. And he saw that everything that rose passed away, and that we live in a conditioned world. So a lot of our experience in life has very little to do with us directly, and more to do with how we relate to the conditions that come our way. And as we do that, we build this stronger and stronger resilience. Deborah, I see you there.
Yeah, I apologize. My computer froze, so I've had to get on and off. I apologize for my tardiness.
Oh, you don't have to apologize. You're
Well,
fine.
I don't want to be disrespectful to the group. So, two things. What you just described, would that be related at all to dependent arising?
Yes, that's what I'm
Okay.
describing.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay. Great.
And this kind of dependent arising, it happens so much in our lives. That's what he saw. He saw, oh my God, all of this is all intersected and dependent on things. And it's sort of like, it's not me. I can observe all this. I can know what's happening, but I am not responsible for fixing everything that happens in my life. I'm not responsible for fixing the world. I'm not responsible for making everything perfect and right. And there's something immensely freeing about that. It's not like we don't want to participate in the world and be of good service and help out as best we can. But what he took away was the responsibility to make everything right. And instead, you just have the integrity, this internal resilience that you're not going to add to the harm in the world. I'm not going to add to it, and I'm going to do the best I can to alleviate whatever pain is around me, and that's it. And that kind of connection with the world in this way actually is a game changer, because being kind and non-harming in a world like today is very, very radical. that's what Sharon Salzberg, she says to practice Dhamma in the world is a radical act of kindness, because the world is very different. And we are learning how to be in this world with this practice. So.
Yeah, and then the other, Nelsie, is it okay if I ask another one?
Yes, we have we still have a few minutes. Thank you, Deborah.
Okay, so you know what I'm doing? I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. I take refuge in the Sangha. Tur, could you explain exactly, because the way I understood Buddha, it was the Buddha nature within myself. So when I'm saying I take refuge in the Buddha, for me, it feels like, well, that's, and I'm probably wrong, something outside myself. It should be internal. So when we say the first one, could you expound on that? I take refuge in the Buddha. Could you expound on that piece of the three?
Yes. So think of it like this. You have to believe that the Buddha, not have to, but it's important that you believe that the Buddha was a regular human being who awoke, who got enlightened, whatever you call it. He woke up. If you don't believe that is possible, then you would be practicing towards what? The practice is towards awakening. So it's true that you take refuge in the Buddha, in your own Buddha nature, that you too, like him, can awaken. But it's just important that we recognize that he actually got enlightened, because that is the point of all of this difficulty and the cultivation of this resilience, is to awaken our hearts and minds, each of us in our own way. So yes, in your own capacity, but it is possible, because he was not a god or a special being. He was a regular person with diligence who freed his own heart and mind. And then once he brought that information in the world, he shared it. And anybody that wants to step onto that path and follow with that diligence can awaken their own heart and mind.
Thank you so much for that clarity. Thank you.
Good. All right. Well, Nelsie, I think we're good.
Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for co-creating this beautiful space with us. Thank you so much, Tuaria. I so enjoyed today's session. And for all of you who may have come in a little late, yes, we are back in sync with Central European time, but the link will be available tomorrow, so you can catch anything that you may have missed or just rewatch and enjoy this session one more time. So as we come to a close today, I'd also love to invite you to continue in the rhythm of this practice with our daily meditation which continues throughout the week. March 30th, tomorrow, March 30th through April 3rd, will be guided by Sophie Boyer at 7 a.m. BST and 8 a.m. CEST. If you, CET, CST. If you can't join live, replays will be available in the Dharma Library, usually by 8 a.m. Eastern Standard. So I will place all those links again in the chat box. Thank you so very much for being here, for your presence, and for practicing together. I wish you all a beautiful rest of your day.